Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, Dr. Peter Graham of the Blue Care Network discusses a wellness toolkit. We talk about catching and treating colorectal cancer. We look at the top fragrance trends from 2025. We talk to the author of Starting From Here and a former TV crime reporter who shares her personal journey.
Here we go. Temperatures up and down. We're spending more time indoors, winter, bringing that perfect storm of challenges, shorter days, you know where we are going. So we've got to stay healthy throughout the winter months. Doesn't have to be complicated. I turn to you, Dr. Peter Graham, Clinical Director for the Blue Care Network. You've created a wellness toolkit. I'm taking notes. Good morning to you, Dr. Graham.
Good morning, Shelley.
Appreciate that. Does winter, increase our risk of, maybe not being as healthy as we should be?
It does, regrettably, and there are a couple of things that lead into that. We tend to spend a lot more time indoors for obvious reasons in Michigan. It's cold and it's icy, and it's also dark a good portion of the daytime, so we tend to be indoors. So a couple things happen. One, we're all kind of clustered together, and one of the things humans tend to do when they're in close proximity is share viruses along with their thoughts and conversation. The other thing we tend to do is be in dry air because it's indoors, and we also don't exercise as much, and we eat the wrong things.
Guilty on a couple of those. So there we are, obviously knowing what could lead to some poor health, yet you have created a wellness toolkit that brings us five daily habits to start, today. What is this toolkit?
Well, it's really fairly straightforward and simple things that you kind of walk through them and hopefully help folks out. The first one, it's a fairly obvious one, but we tend to all overlook it from time to time. Wash your hands. It's still kind of not completely understood by a lot of folks. Most of the viruses that you pick up are contacted from hand to hand, either coming in contact with surfaces that you shouldn't or spreading them to other people. Touching surfaces, then touching your face, your eyes, your nose, your mouth, which we all do kind of consciously or subconsciously hundreds of times during the day. So making sure you're washing your hands with soap and water, if it's available. You make sure it's a good 20 seconds, not just kind of lightly splash them under the water and then dry them off. You really need both the friction under the water and soap, which helps remove a lot of grime and also destroys a lot of viruses and bacteria. And particularly some of the activities that we would think of where you should wash your hands, like preparing food, handling trash or garbage, or caring for sick people yourself. And I think we would all know this one after you've used the bathroom. Mm-hmm. Make sure you wash your hands thoroughly. That's one.
One. All right, give me a couple more, yeah.
Sure. The second one, getting your flu shots. This one is a really important one. We're on the cusp of a pretty challenging flu season. We just kind of forgot about influenza a little bit during the COVID pandemic. Influenza is still out there, still pretty common. It can make you awfully sick. Flu shots are very, very effective. They're very, very safe and very available, so make sure you get one. If you're curious about or think you need other potential vaccines like COVID booster, pneumonia, or RSV, those are also good ones to catch up on. And your best one-stop shop for that is your own family doc. They will be able to help guide you through what is appropriate for you. Most of the time, they can actually provide them for you on site, so that's an important thing to keep up with. Hydration. This is another one that we tend to forget about. We're looking out the window at a lot of frozen water in our lawns and driveways, but it's not in the air. It's frozen out. And winter air tends to be very, very dry. The air in the spaces we inhabit tends to be very, very dry, mostly because we heat our houses with gas heat. The net effect of that is that we get dried out, and when humans get dehydrated, bad things happen. It dries out your skin. It can make respiratory symptoms worse, makes you tired. Also, ironically, makes us tend to eat more. And not always the things we're supposed to. So make sure you're drinking plenty of water is ideal, by the way. You don't need, and please stay away from things like sports drinks and alcohol. They tend to dry out more, just bring in a lot of sugar. So, you know, good old-fashioned water, decaf beverages or things like that. Fruits and vegetables also help quite a bit. They have high water content in things like soups. That's one of the reasons people tend to like to eat and take those in during the winter, so make sure you stay hydrated. Sleep. This is another one that folks don't always focus. Well, you know, our bodies are telling us, and we all kind of want to hibernate this time of year, and I get it. I can go on and on about how important sleep is to us physiologically. It's a time when your body repairs itself. It's a time when your brain kind of resets a little bit. You know, we don't still understand the complete chemistry of it, but it's really important to get enough sleep. So a couple tips and pointers on that, avoiding alcohol and caffeine, obviously. A lot of folks think still a nightcap is something that helps you sleep. It actually is not conducive to good sleep, so try to go easy on the alcohol. That's one of the things we tend to do a lot more of this time of year. Good routine is important. You know, set a bedtime, a regular bedtime. Most of us have a pretty regular wake-up schedule, but you know, be good about disciplining yourself to actually get in bed. And by the way, be in bed means going to sleep. It doesn't mean doom scrolling on social media on your iPad or your iPhone. You know, make sure you're doing some relaxing things before bedtime and try to avoid the screens as much as you can. And last but not least, stay as physically active as you possibly can. We tend to really slack off on the exercise during the winter months. I'm as guilty of this as anybody. Obviously, it's cold, which tends to make it less pleasant to be outdoors and exercise. But we also worry about things like slip hazards and the rest, which is very reasonable. What you should be aiming for is, you know, about 150 minutes a week. You know, spread out over the week as best you can. Think about things like, I know it feels a little geriatric to a lot of us, but it's actually a good way to do it. Things like mall walking, or if you're working in an indoor space, being able to walk the perimeters or stairways, that's a good way to get some steps in and some exercise. An exercise class or something like a dance class or something like that, fun, nice thing to do with a partner if you have one, or a friend even. You know, lots of ways you can get that in. Even things like house cleaning, we don't typically think of as exercise, that's still activity from your body's point of view. So get yourself up moving, ideally at least once a day. That really does, and it also helps with sleep and a few of these other things. So those are the five things that I'd really encourage people to look at to try to stay healthier during the winter.
Very cool. Five very important. Dr. Peter Graham, again, the clinical director for the Blue Care Network, a wellness toolkit we are discussing. What else do we need to know about seasonal vaccines?
Seasonal vaccines, I think the thing I'd highlight is, you know, they're available, they're covered by your insurance in pretty much every case. They're very, very effective. I know those are the things that typically worry people is, am I going to have to pay for this? Where am I going to get it? And does it work? And the answer to all three is in the affirmative. And particularly flu is the one I would really hammer on the most at the moment. I know everybody has a story or a friend out there, I got the flu vaccine, and then the day later I got the flu. It is impossible. It can't do that. It's an inactivated virus. It will not make you sick. It will actually keep you from ending up in the hospital or worse. It's one of those things you really want to make sure you get on board and get it on board early. That's the other thing. It's never too late, by the way, but it doesn't really help you once you've been exposed or you're already sick. You really need to get it in your system and have time for your immune system to react to it and build up the antibodies you need to influenza. The rest of them, like I mentioned, COVID, RSV, pneumonia, important respiratory vaccines, those are ones you want to talk to your family doctor about, because you may or may not, it may or may not make sense for you to have those yet, depending on how old you are or what other health issues you might or might not have. But a really, really important conversation to have with your family doctor or internist or pediatrician.
Yes, and of course, get to be creative, as you mentioned, to move out, move indoors, move outdoors, and more. All right. Well, what's a resource for me? How do I find out more information about your wellness toolkit?
MIBlueDaily.com is a great source. If you're of a mind, there are all sorts of things, not just the winter toolkit, but other sources of health information on there. I encourage people to visit it. You do not need to be a Blue Cross member to visit the site, by the way. So lots of really, really good health information there.
Yes. Well, if you're a mall walker, at least get a couple of rounds in before you stop a shop. There you are. Okay.
There you go.
You rock. Thanks a lot, Dr. Graham. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Why is your biomarker status essential? That's the conversation we are to have with our next guests. Advances in biomarker testing are transforming colorectal cancer treatment, offering patients precision-based therapies tailored to their cancer's unique profile. Let's talk about the answer to that initial question. Good that you are here, Dr. Christopher Liu, gastrointestinal oncologist, medical advisor for the Colorectal Cancer Alliance. Dr. Liu, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Welcome. Michelle Kappel, thank you. You hear a colorectal cancer patient to share a bit of your story. Hi to you, Michelle.
Good morning.
All right, let's get into the details, the basics. Dr. Liu, what exactly are biomarkers and why are they so important in treating, well, our niche of colorectal cancer today?
Well, Shelley, this is without question the most exciting time ever in the history of treatment for colorectal cancer and personalized therapy for colorectal cancer. But that all starts with biomarker testing. So what are biomarkers? Biomarkers are essentially like a biological fingerprint for cancer. It's what makes each tumor different than anybody else's tumor. And this can be a gene, it can be a protein. A lot of times we talk about biomarkers in terms of mutations, but it's really just any characteristic of a tumor that makes that tumor unique to that patient that has colorectal cancer. But this is critically important information because when we know somebody's biomarker status, we can offer them the right treatment for the right patient.
Staying with you, just as a follow-up, how does biomarker testing, I guess, change the treatment journey for patients compared to traditional approaches?
Yeah, and you know, when you think about the historical way we've treated cancer, it's oftentimes been a one-size-fits-all treatment for any patient diagnosed with colorectal cancer. And this often means giving somebody chemotherapy, and we certainly know that chemotherapy, while it might be effective, it also has a lot of side effects. And we know that patients a lot of times don't feel very well on chemotherapy. So how much better and how much more effective would it be if our patients were to receive personalized therapy, a therapy plan that was designed based off of biomarker testing that would treat that patient's cancer uniquely and individually? And so I talked about giving the right treatment to the right patient, and oftentimes this means giving a patient something like targeted therapy or even immune therapy, where we try to teach the patient's immune system how to fight cancer. Now, when we do this, we know that patients experience less side effects, that they feel better, and most importantly, that they live longer. So again, biomarker testing, critical to offering the right treatment for the right patient.
Yes, bringing you into the conversation, Michelle, diagnosed with stage 4 colorectal cancer. Talk about biomarker testing and how that changed your story.
So I was diagnosed stage 4 in 2017. At that time, I was told I was at best a year. So I was not okay with that. I went for a second opinion. In that second opinion, biomarker testing was done. And so a plan was set up just uniquely for me. And obviously, it has saved my life. It's 2025, and I am still here, and I should not be here.
And what was it like, and I'm glad you're still here, to learn that there was a targeted treatment that could actually work for you?
It gave me so much hope and empowerment because the initial consultation that had told me I had a year at best, that was no longer the case. The case now was your treatment is only going to get better and better as we go on. So it just put me in the driver's seat. I wasn't on a one-size-fit-all treatment plan. I was on something specific for me.
Dr. Liu, again, what would be some of the most promising advances in biomarker-driven therapies right now in somewhat summary?
Yeah, and Shelley, this is really something that's changing, honestly, month to month when you look at all the FDA approvals for patients with really any cancer, but certainly colorectal cancer. And so the advancements have really been to start taking steps away from chemotherapy and steps towards biomarker-directed therapies that often include targeted therapies or immuno-oncology treatments. And, you know, for a small subset of patients with colorectal cancer, they shouldn't even receive chemotherapy, but should actually start with immune therapies first. And what we know in a lot of situations, when patients get biomarker-directed therapy, oftentimes there can be even a doubling of overall survival, and that's really, really exciting.
Talking on behalf of the Colorectal Cancer Alliance, guests on behalf of biomarker testing and colorectal cancer, Dr. Christopher Liu and patient Michelle Kappel. Michelle, for patients who may be overwhelmed, as you remember, by a new diagnosis, talk about the advice you'd give, about asking for biomarker testing.
So when you're first diagnosed, it's a whirlwind, and you don't know what's going on around you. They need to be their best advocate. No one is going to speak up for them but the patient themselves. So it is essential to make sure that they talk with their doctors and ask for biomarker testing, because it's not done right now at every single hospital, and it can make the difference and save somebody's life. Also, I do encourage people to get involved. I have chosen to partner with the Colorectal Cancer Alliance for this reason, because that they put a strong emphasis on biomarker testing and are trying to get even more insurance companies and hospitals on board.
Thank you for you speaking out about your journey. And yes, so much to look ahead to. Your final question, Dr. Christopher Liu, and perhaps how to find out more about the wonderful Colorectal Cancer Alliance.
Yeah, you know, the biggest thing here is just to raise awareness, and just so appreciative of Michelle sharing her story, which is really remarkable, but really proves the importance of biomarker testing for patients with colorectal cancer. The Colorectal Cancer Alliance is the largest patient advocacy organization, really trying to, again, raise awareness for biomarker testing in colorectal cancer. For more information, you can go to colorectalcancer.org/biomarkers. That's colorectalcancer.org/biomarkers.
Thank you both. Happy holidays, and stay the course. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Did you know there is the Fragrance Foundation? And it's important, according to President Linda G. Levy on the line. This is kind of cool. Let's break down leading trends and ask you to share some simple ways to find, well, a right scent for everyone. I'm glad you're here, Linda. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Shelley. It's a pleasure to be with you. Holiday time is a great time to gift fragrance. It comes in many, many forms, and there are some forms that are not personal fragrances that are for the home. So the variety of fragrances in this year, 2025, was huge. There's hundreds of new fragrances, and we're going to be talking about some of them very specifically, Shelley.
Thank you very much. Before we do that, I mean, there is a wonderful Fragrance Foundation. Is that your job to make sure that we're smelling pretty good?
Yeah, I'm so lucky to be the president of the Fragrance Foundation. It's like living in a candy store if you really like candy, or in a bakery where you really like cookies. The wonderful thing about fragrance in this day and age is it really transports people. It helps their identity. We call it the invisible accessory. And we have 150 member companies across the United States of America. So we've got thousands of people in this industry who are really excited about their category and selling it at holiday time.
Yes, as we are in the thick of. All right, let's get into the conversation. Key fragrance trends. What are you seeing emerge, Linda?
Well, this year is very interesting. We always have a lot of new trends. I would say one of the biggest trends is particularly for more intense fragrances rather than light ones. So in the summer, you might really want a light floral or citrus, you know, for your day out and about. But this time of year, it's perfect because we've got some new things. A few examples would be Marc Jacobs comes out with a new fragrance every single year, and this one called Marc Jacobs Perfect is an absolute eau de parfum. It's an adorable bottle. It's less than $200 in almost every store, and it's a beautiful new intense fragrance. So intense is a big thing.
Thank you for that. What about giftable scents? I mean, how do I know what my aunt would like?
It's a lot of people think it's a very complicated conversation, but it's not. If you think of it simply as different classifications that you would understand, there could be floral, there could be spicy, there could be sweet. Just by knowing what type of fragrance in that manner, if you go into any store or online, it would help you hone in onto a category that you probably most identify with the person that you are gifting.
Linda Levy on the line, president of the Fragrance Foundation. You know what we're talking about, those smells available for gifts or for yourself. And then I do ask, formats beyond traditional perfume, Linda, what do we need to know about the options? Are we doing the body sprays, mists, and home fragrances?
Yes, we are. Body sprays and hair mists are very popular with young gals. So people are running into Sephora looking at so many different brands, and they're fairly inexpensive. You know, most of them are less than like $50, $60. Another great way to gift and another format are the home versions of fragrance. Candles, diffusers, home sprays, really popular. Nest, as an example, is a great example of an American brand that has been stupendous in selling every single format of home fragrances.
And I guess I'll ask the guidance you can offer to help match a fragrance to someone's preferences for anyone actually trying to choose a personal giftable scent, somewhat in review.
Yeah, I would go back to the classifications, Shelley. I think if a woman likes something very sweet, vanilla is a very big trend. You can't go wrong with that. It's in so many different fragrances offered out there. And men's fragrances tend to be more woodsy. There's a brand new Paradigm that came out of Prada. There's a brand new version of Aramis, one of the old standards in the beauty business. So most of the time things are either specific for men, specific for women, or also universal. Some fragrances could be worn by any gender identity.
Nice. And of course, yes, I see we are, instead of focusing on singular signature scents, you're asking us to explore fragrance, wardrobes, and more. Where do I start? Let's just say I'm finding the best scent for myself or a gift in closing, Linda.
Well, I would say, just like an outfit, you wouldn't wear the same thing if you were going to play tennis or going to a baseball game versus going into the studio where you are or going to a black tie. So think of fragrance as the last touch, the invisible accessory, we like to call it, and build your collection for the mood and the outfit that you're wearing, because you'd never wear the same outfit at those various activities, I'm sure.
No, probably have the tennis gear versus the black tie gala on a separate venue. All right, how do I find out more information, Linda?
Well, you can go on the World Wide Web at www.fragrance.org, or if you're into social media as we are at the Fragrance Foundation, please follow us at Fragrance Foundation. Every day of the week we show a new fragrance that's a member of the Fragrance Foundation, and you will have quite a big collection if you start following us, Shelley.
Yes. And you're okay with being recognized as the fragrance queen, right?
I'm not wearing my tiara. You can't see me today, but I am complimented to be such.
That
I
is.
I am the fragrance queen here.
As you should be. Thank you for your many executive leadership roles. Appreciate you. All right. Happy holidays, and thanks for the scent update.
Thank you, Shelley. A pleasure, and happy holidays to you.
Yeah. Little birdie tells me my next guest presents impressive work and solid conversation. So we bring you on, Paula Saunders, a gorgeous, evocative book, a real writer's writer, and your story, semi-autobiographical. Let's talk about you leaving home at a very early age to dance, leaving you vulnerable, and we'll talk about the rest of the story, as they say. Your latest book is out, Starting From Here. Good morning, Paula.
Oh, good morning, Shelley. Thank you.
Yes. You miss those days in Rapid City, South Dakota?
Well, to tell the truth, I kind of do. I mean, Rapid City is a beautiful place, and South Dakota is so beautiful. The Black Hills are gorgeous. So, yeah, it's a place that one can miss. And I left so early. I left it when I was 15. Like the protagonist in my new book, that's what I did. And, so I've missed it for a long time.
Yes, let's talk about your book. Yes, you do draw upon details from your own life to study ballet. You did. What is your storyline, Paula?
Okay, I left when I was 15, and I went away to study ballet. It's kind of in the book, actually. I went to Phoenix, and I studied there for a while and moved around a little bit and ended up dancing with Harkness Ballet in New York City. That's kind of the overall storyline, like that the surface storyline. The deeper storyline is that, you know, this young girl has basically three reasons or three things she's trying to accomplish through her adolescence. And one is to get to a place where she can, you know, perfect her art or work on her skills. The second thing is to get away from the turmoil of her family. And the third thing is, you know, she's 15 years old. She has to move from being a girl to being a young woman. And so that transition has to happen regardless of where she is or whether she's on her own or with her family, but she's on her own. That was also my story. I was on my own and had to make those transitions and try to accomplish my goals in that way.
Well, I don't want to give away the ending, but obviously you have, I trust, accomplished many a goal. So life did work for you. But let's talk about who we are, how we find. Do you use Renee as your name for your protagonist?
Renee is the protagonist in the book. Exactly. Yes.
All right. She's sent to train alongside stick-thin sculpted girls in Phoenix, then to Denver and more. Let's talk a little bit about the dazzling sequence of characters she meets. Is there a predatory radio announcer?
Yes, there is a predatory radio announcer in the book and also in life. I mean, I think what happens is, you know, young girls going through this particular transition from girl to young woman, that's a very kind of treacherous time. And that's kind of, for me, that was a lot of the weight of what the book is about and what I wanted to talk about, because I think that what we tend to do is look at young girls in that transition time and a little bit blame them for what they're going through and, you know, kind of awakening to their own sexuality and their own needs and trying to figure out where they are in the world. And my feeling is we need to kind of understand that moment more for young women and support them more through that time and see them in a positive light. What happened with me and what happens in the book is that this young woman is, you know, sent away to study ballet, but she's on her own. She doesn't have the protection of her family. And so there are all of these predatory figures in our culture. We can see that even today, obviously, in the news. So they are there and they are ready to manifest for people who don't have the protection they need. So we need to offer that for the young people in our culture.
Does your character, did you experience mean girls?
Oh, have we all experienced mean girls?
This one even took my boyfriend in junior high, but we won't go there.
Right? Exactly. We've all experienced that. And, you know, I mean, I kind of have to say, too, I haven't been immune from being the mean girl. This is just part of how our dynamic is set up with young women. We, you know, isn't it funny? Like we kind of, young women are set against each other a little bit because, you know, we understand as we're coming up that we're going to miss out on something somehow, and we need to fight fight each other for what we can get. And I think that that has to change. And I think it is changing, actually. I think it is changing. From what I see in the younger generation, like my daughters, and after that, young women are supporting each other better than we did. So, I'm hoping that's the case, and I'd like to encourage it.
Yes, the book is Starting From Here, a novel, Paula Saunders, also author of The Distance Home. You also present, looks like, some creepy dads. Is that the correct term?
Oh, creepy.
Creepy.
Yeah, creepy dads.
Now, give me an example.
Oh, okay. Well, you know how, sometimes, maybe I'm sure you felt this too, when you're 15, 16 years old, there'll be the dad of somebody who'll give you that side eye look that just like kind of creeps you out. That's what I'm talking about. So there's always that kind of, you as a young woman are going through this transition that is natural for you, that you need to grow into. But there's always that kind of cultural, social, sexual thing that happens where, you know, people will notice and there are undertones and you notice the undertones. So it becomes kind of a complicated cycle where you're not really in control of your own experience. There's always someone intruding, or not always, but sometimes there's someone intruding, and often that's a creepy dad.
Are there themes in a take-home message from Starting From Here?
Well, I can point to the title. I hope there are a lot of themes. There's a mother-daughter relationship that's complicated, that has some resolution. I'm hoping there's the theme of self-forgiveness and forgiveness of others. And I know there's the theme of starting from here, which, you know, has a layered meaning in this book. Starting from here, this young woman is starting from a socioeconomic background that doesn't give her an advantage. She's coming from a cattle trading family for generations, trying to become a professional classical ballet dancer. That's a very impossible transition. So she's starting from a place where she doesn't have advantages. The other meaning of starting from here is at the beginning of the book, she's at the beginning of her journey. And at the end of the book, we see she's also at the beginning of her journey. And so I feel like that's really important for all of us, because we're always starting from wherever we are. And we need to remember that.
I like that. All right. Starting From Here by you, Paula Saunders. Thank you very much. Talk to me about how we find out more information and get your book.
You can get the book at any place you get your books, any place you like to buy your books. You can also get it at penguinrandomhouse.com. And you can find out more about me and my first book, The Distance Home, at paulasaundersbooks.com.
As easy as that. All right. Thanks for reminding us of your good journey in a novel type form, and keep the faith. And thanks for the read. Take care, Paula.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
She's dubbed an extraordinary messenger. Her life is enthralling, inspiring, heart-wrenching, and at times traumatic, and she writes about it. Former TV crime reporter from one of the top U.S. markets, Beth McDonough, on the line. In the House, Standby is her latest, exploring her personal battles, stigmatized conditions, and more. Let's talk to you with your memoir, Beth. Good to speak with you. Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to speak with you, too. Thank you for having me.
Do you miss your crime reporting?
Sometimes, yes. You know, it was in my blood, and I loved it, and I did it for 30 years. So that just doesn't disappear overnight.
Yes. Thank you for sharing your life in Standby, a word we often say in this business. It's described as a riveting book. You have had challenges, I trust, overcome many, and yet here you are to remind us all of us can start over. Would you set the scene for us, Beth, with your latest work?
Absolutely. So Standby is the first of two memoirs, And it begins, it's not a soft start of a book. I start people off right where I kind of came to, which was in jail. So my book, I take people through what happened to me back in 2007, 2008. I got two DUIs back to back. And I was living in Minnesota at the time and working for Fox News, the network, and the local station there. And, you know, as we do sometimes after our shifts, if you work the evening shift in the news, I would go out and have drinks with coworkers after work. And you can always make a bunch of bad decisions whenever alcohol is involved, and I did. So after the first DUI, I got into a little bit of trouble. And there was a little blurb in the paper. I was suspended and got a pretty good tongue lashing. And at that time, my boss asked me, you know, Beth, do you have a problem? And shame being the powerful tool that it is really held me back because no one wants to grow up and be known as an alcoholic or certainly labeled as an alcoholic. And I said, no, I'm not. And he said, if you are, if you have a problem, Beth, we can get you help. And you know, I denied, really thinking that I would be able to get on top of this. But, you know, alcohol doesn't negotiate. And I was somehow able to keep my job. But there was a very stern warning that if it ever happened again, that was it. Because Fox generally has a zero tolerance policy. And but they gave me an exception, and I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse. Mm-hmm. So when I got my second DUI on Halloween night of 2008, and I hit someone on the highway at 80 miles an hour, he's okay. His car bumper, the back bumper, was damaged. And by the time I got home, police were waiting for me there. And I was in a blackout, and so the book starts where I wake up on the jail cot. I actually still had cuffs on my wrist at the time, but I was on the jail cot, you know, in an orange jumpsuit, in the drunk tank with other women. And when I came to, they were watching the television news, because what else do you do when you're in jail? But you talk and you pass the time and watch TV. Mm-hmm. And my mugshot and the story about me popped up on this big screen in the holding cell. And that was my pretty good gut punch. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of hear all the women talking about me of like, ooh, whoever she is, I bet she's in here somewhere. I bet her life is screwed, you know, da-da-da. And I thought, they have no idea it's me they're talking about. And yes, my life was on the brink at that point.
Yes. So
I wanted to just start writing the book to kind of get the guts of it out of me, what happened, because people tend to write or share their stories when they're safely on the other side. And I wanted to start writing this book through all the ugly parts of what DUIs and recovery looks like, to give people a very realistic view of it, but also to show people, here's what you go through and it can be done.
Stand by Beth McDenna on the line. Talk to me more about, obviously, I don't want to give too much away. There has been healing in your life. What was writing part of your healing process?
Absolutely. When I started writing it, I was really in the thick of it, and I was on house arrest for 37 days, which is a lot of time to be alone and up in your head, especially as an alcoholic when you're very early in recovery. I was 1 month in. I had just gotten home from treatment, still facing some major court consequences. And I did start writing the book for me to get all the gunk out. And it was kind of therapeutic. As a writer, being a journalist for 30 years, you write our own stuff in news, right? And so I thought, well, let me sit down and start to write and just get this out. You know, it's my form of journaling. And as I started writing more and more about this and my experiences of the surreal experiences, whether it was in jail or the workhouse or the court hearings, then I realized I was also writing this to reach out to people who also perhaps felt defeated by their own bad choices in life. And through the journey and the discoveries, the insights, and the truth that I learned, although my book is personal because it's a memoir, but it really resonates with anyone, whether they're going through recovery or they have regrets in life or they're trying to reinvent themselves. So it casts a wide net. But I didn't hide any of the ugly parts. I really wanted people to understand, you know, they may know from the outside, hey, this crime reporter, and it's hard to be a crime reporter when you commit a crime, you know, but this crime reporter, this is what she went through. And if it worked for her, maybe it works for me too.
Yes. And lastly, just a couple minutes left, Beth, what did work for you to get to where you are today?
Well, number one, accepting, owning up and accepting that I have a problem, that I had a drinking problem, and it was time to deal with it. Two DUIs will really get your attention. But not just that, when you get fired from the job, the news reporting job that you love more than anything on earth, that really got my attention. And my boss at that time did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And in fact, when I got fired, I'd lost my car and my license. And when I was still at the TV station, he said, you know, we've got a taxi waiting for you. You can either take it home or you can go to treatment. It's up to you. And I went to treatment. I worked a 30-day program, inpatient therapy, taking on a sober roommate when I got out. AA worked wonders for me. I would say that it almost saved my life. I went to AA every day for the first year, one meeting a day for the first year. I think that commitment, help, and support really got me over the worst of it, to where, you know, even the judge, when he was sentencing me, he asked to see me in private in his chambers during my court hearing. And boy, I was scared to go in those chambers and face him. And when I did, he said, you know, as soon as your name came on my docket, I started following your criminal case. And he said, I knew I wanted to have this conversation with you. And when I came around the corner to go into his chambers, his arms were outstretched to hug me, and which blew my mind and brought me to tears. And he said, I understand what you're going through. Today is my 20-year anniversary of sobriety, he said. And I thought, oh, this mercy that he showed me, and this wisdom and understanding, I want to pass that on to other people. Like, going through this whole experience can't be for naught. There's got to be takeaway that I can share with other people. And, you know, I have a platform and a little bit of name recognition. And I want to, you know, show people DUIs aren't what you want to get. Here's why. Here's what alcohol can do to your life. And while I was in treatment, as well, I also realized people used to say when I had one drink, I went from 0 to 100 pretty quickly. And I learned in treatment the medical facts of that, that we women, we absorb 30% more alcohol than men. So the inebriating effects on us are much more powerful because we have more fat on our bodies and men have more water. Well, alcohol dissolves in water. So, you know, men can handle the alcohol more than women. And I thought, well, that explains why I go from 0 to 100. You know, there's a medical aspect of this too. So I really wanted to share all of this with people because I couldn't hide anymore. Shame had kept me in the dark and hiding my demons. And I thought, well, gosh, if I can come out and just be as brutally honest about things that happened along the way that I did, because this was self-imposed. You know, I did this to people. They didn't do it to me. That it might encourage others to face their truth and their issues and realize you can be broken and you can be brave and you grow from what you go through.
Beth McDonough, again, McDonough, your book, Stand By. How do we find out more information and get your book?
Yes, so I've got a website up now. It's called www.BethMcDMedia.com. So people can go there and sign up to be on a wait list. We've got a wait list going now. And the next round of books will be out in just a couple of weeks. And I would love to share my story with as many souls as possible who need it, that could connect with it and make a difference in their lives. And I also want people to know you know, I went broke. I lost my home. I lost my car. I lost my license. I lost my job. Mm. I lost a lot of my friends and family. But all of that destruction developed me into such a better person that I didn't just come back. I came back even stronger, and others can too.
Good. Thank you for that. Author, journalist, model, you, writing, stand by. Thank you to you, Beth McDonough. Take care.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.